Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's a pleasure to have you all here tonight. I think Susan and I are going to have microphone battles here because I'm tall and she's not tall, but we're going to do our best, so please tell us if you have a problem hearing us tonight and we'll adjust the mic through the evening. It's a real pleasure to have you here for the first event of our third month of events this fall. And I'm really happy to let you know that this is the first event that we've had this fall where the rest of the building is open again. Our renovation, for those of you who are members, is pretty much completed, and the fifth floor that has private study and writing and the hornblower room is open again as of Monday. And we're quite thrilled, and all the staff in the building are wiping their brows and are happy that the renovation is over. If you're a guest with us tonight and would like information on the library and a membership application, just check at the front desk when you leave downstairs. And as you're leaving the room tonight, if you're new to the library, please have a look at the skylight as well, which is just outside this building. We just revealed the skylight and did a big project this summer to take it back to the original look of the Rogers House. And it was a big project this summer to uncover it and do restoration, and it's quite beautiful, and hope you'll all enjoy it. Before I introduce our speaker, Susan Cheever, may I ask you to just take a moment, if you have cell phones, pagers, anything that's electronic and might buzz or ring, if you could take it out in silence, it would really appreciate it. I would like to take just a quick moment to talk about our annual fund. Gifts to the fund are essential to support our day-to-day operations and to make evenings like this one possible. And on behalf of the board and the staff of the library, I want to thank those of you who have already contributed and encourage everyone else to send in your contributions when you have time. Stick to your teaching, Miss Alcott. You can't write. Those were the rather harsh words said by James T. Fields to Louisa May Alcott. I'm sure our speaker here tonight can share the story of how Fields' remarks contributed to the author's desire to become a writer and eventually to her success. I'm also sure that Susan will speak about why Alcott's works still resonate with so many people today, from Little Women, of course, to her letters and journals, and even some of the books that we've pulled out tonight that you can have a look at after, including a couple of first editions of Hospital Sketches from 1863. Please feel free to come up after the event and have a look at it. And Comic Tragedies, a very nice first edition from 1893. Susan Cheever is with us tonight with her new book, just out this week, and I'm very happy to let you know it's the first stop on her book tour. Her new book is Louisa May Alcott, A Personal Biography, published by Simon & Schuster. Susan, as many of you know, is a best-selling author of over a dozen books, including American Bloomsbury, Notes Found in the Bottle, and Home Before Dark. She's received a number of awards during her career, including the Guggenheim Fellowship and an Associated Press Award. Please join me in welcoming Susan Cheever.
Little Women was the book that changed Louisa Alcott's life and made her rich and famous, but she didn't want to write it. She didn't want to write it at all. It was the last thing on earth she wanted to do. She approached it in a rage with tremendous reluctance, and she came to that point through a series of what seemed like unfortunate accidents and discouragement. And one of the things that fascinates me about her life and our lives is the way when you look back on your life, it looks like destiny. But when you look forward, it looks like a series of unfortunate accidents. Louisa May Alcott came from an extraordinary family. She was 36 years old when she sat down to write Little Women in 1868. She was the second daughter of four daughters in a family living in and around Boston. Her father was a visionary and something of a jerk named Bronson Alcott. He was a progressive educator who had married an aristocrat without much money. Bronson was actually an education genius. He believed that children came from God, as Wordsworth had said a few years earlier. Most people in those days thought that children were vipers who had to be tamed and civilized in order to fit in with society. Bronson felt that they trailed clouds of glory. And so his schools, of course, were tremendously popular because instead of beating the children and forcing them to memorize things, he had fun with them and taught them in the way that seems much more congenial to us now but was very revolutionary then. And the first students that he had were his own children. He was fascinated by children. He felt he was a student of children. And, of course, he used his own four daughters as if they were lab rats. He did his first clinical trials on Louisa and her sisters. And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. I'm going to go back and forth between reading and talking this evening. And let me also say it's an honor and a pleasure to be in this room where I've spent so many happy hours watching the dust motes come across the afternoon light and wondering why I wasn't upstairs working on my book. Okay, in one experiment, and now I'm reading, Bronson produced an apple just before dinner time when his subjects were especially hungry and asked Anna, that's the older sister, pointedly if little girls should take things that did not belong to them without asking. No, Anna responded obediently, they should not. Then he asked both Anna and Louisa if they would ever do such a thing as take an apple without asking for it. They both agreed that they would not. Yet, when Bronson returned to the room after dinner, the apple had been reduced to a core next to Louisa's place at the dinner table. Bronson asked what it was. Apple, admitted the honest Louisa. Remember, she's 3 years old. Anna, always the pleasing child, blurted out the whole story, a story in which she and Louisa had both tried to get the apple, but Louisa had gotten there first. Then Louisa had eaten some of it. Anna had grabbed it and thrown it into the grate, but Louisa had fished it out and eaten some more. Louisa, as usual, was the villain of the piece. Bronson always believed Anna. Louisa confessed that she had eaten the apple because I wanted it. Then, sensing that she had somehow failed, she added, I was naughty. In another apple experiment, Bronson left an apple on the wardrobe alone with Louisa, who put up a valiant struggle as her father and mother secretly listened and took notes. During the course of the morning, Louisa's mother reported that she several times took the apple in her hands and caressed it wistfully. No, no, father's, me not take father's apple. Naughty, naughty, she said. Then she succumbed and ate the apple. When confronted by her mother, she explained, me could not help it, me must have it. So you can see what kind of child she was from the beginning and what kind of parents she had. They were all over their daughters, and Louisa was the naughty one. Bronson was very thrilled to see that she actually had a conscience. She knew when she was being naughty. But she was definitely the renegade from the beginning. And she also was the one with the dark hair, which Bronson believed meant you were satanic. Just another note about why some people think Bronson was a jerk. Bronson provided his daughters and his wife with an amazing community in which to live. Although they moved 30 times, they were incredibly poor. They often didn't have enough to eat. Bronson's friends were Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Nathaniel Hawthorne. So that although Louisa didn't go to school very much, she grew up in this unbelievably rich intellectual atmosphere. And she used Emerson's library the way we use this library. And Thoreau took her for walks and taught her about nature. So this unbelievable transcendental community in which she grew up was really a gift from her father. And, you know, one of the things about Bronson, he had all these fancy, wonderful, smart friends, and they all revered him. And Bronson was a great conversationalist, but he was a terrible writer. Somebody once said, and this came as a shock to everybody, because apparently he was quite an impressive guy till you asked him to write an essay, and then you were very sorry. Somebody said that reading Bronson's prose was like watching 15 boxcars go by with only one passenger in them. And James Russell Lowell even wrote a poem about how Bronson couldn't write. While he talks, he is great, but goes out like a taper if you shut him up closely with pen, ink, and paper. And it goes on like that. So Bronson famously was a bad writer, and he became more and more famous for his bad writing as the years went on. And at first, it looked as if Louisa was also a bad writer. Here's a story which you've heard part of, but Louisa had decided very early on that she wanted to be a writer and that she wanted to make money. Two things which, of course, do not always go together. So she struggled and struggled to make herself into a writer. She had written some, what she called her blood and thunder stories for Frank Leslie's Illustrated News, very melodramatic stories, which she was ashamed of, and she wrote them under a pseudonym. She had published some poems. She had published some stories. And in 1854, when she was 21, she decided that she would really, you know, become a writer, and that she would go and see the great editor of her time, of their time, James T. Fields. James T. Fields was Hawthorne's editor. He was De Quincey's editor. He was the man who would become the sort of Maxwell Perkins of the 1840s and 50s, a very famous guy. So Louisa had been, you know, she made money, some money from writing, some money from being a seamstress, some money from teaching, and she had gone to be a companion to a man who turned out to be very unpleasant in New Hampshire. And she had been there for 6 weeks, and she wrote an essay about it called When I Went Out to Service. So she thought she would take this memoir essay to James Fields and see what he thought, and he would anoint her as a writer, and she would be on her way. So I'm reading again. She passed the Boston Common and turned into the bustling center of downtown. There the spire of the Old South Church presided like a disapproving Puritan dowager over the teeming business of the New Boston. There was the bookshop next to Mrs. Abner's coffee house, where Fields took authors and colleagues for coffee and hot buns. There was the gorgeous palace of the music hall with its golden gaslit interiors, where Louisa had already been to see Madame Henriette Sontag sing Rossini, and where she had recently gone to hear Theodore Parker, one of her favorite speakers and a fervent abolitionist, demand equality for women. Now Louisa headed for the second floor of the old corner bookshop, where Fields had his office behind a green curtain that separated him from his young assistant, Thomas Niles, and the piles of manuscripts he had yet to read. She handed him the manuscript, her first and last memoir essay, How I Went Out to Service. He motioned her to sit and began to read. She could hear the noise of Thomas Niles' pen scratching and the chatter in the bookstore downstairs. The air smelled of paper and ink. Finally, the great James T. Fields, you know what's going to happen, looked up at her and delivered the verdict she would remember for the rest of her life. Stick to your teaching, Miss Alcott. You can't write. So this is a famous moment where she takes her life in her hands. She walks across the common. She goes to see this guy, and he says, stick to your teaching. You can't write. And he actually encouraged her teaching. He actually loaned her $40 to help her start a school. So he really was trying to be nice. But, of course, this is the moment at which she actually became a writer. As you all who are writers know, if you don't thrive on discouragement, you are not going to make it as a writer. I often think that the principal engine behind most writing is perversity. It may be that the principal engine behind most success is perversity. I mean, now there are these psychological studies that say we should have said to our children, you'll never amount to anything, so that they could have spent their energy proving us wrong instead of saying to our children, you can do whatever you want, and they did whatever they wanted. But Louisa had this perversity, and you can see it in the apple scene, and you can see it all the way through her life, so that when James T. Fields said to her, you can't write, something inside her went, oh, yes, I can. And I do think this is a very, very interesting moment. But her trials were not over. She then decided that she was going to write a serious novel. And her serious novel, which I'm sure not many of you read, was called Moods. And it's a novel about a young woman who goes on a river trip with two men, one a man very much like Henry David Thoreau, who she had a desperate crush on, and another a man very much like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who she also had a crush on. And these three people travel up the river, and, you know, she ends up marrying the Emerson character and then realizing that she's in love with the Thoreau character. And it's a terrible book, and they all die in a shipwreck. You know, that's how she solves the problem. But she thought it was a terrific book. She started it with an epigraph from Emerson, and she worked very hard on it. She had to cut it in half to get it published. That may sound familiar. And it finally came out in 1864, and it got terrible reviews. And the worst review it got was from a young man named Henry James, who was writing for the North American Review, and he wrote that what Alcott was trying to do in Moods had already been done better in Europe, and that her doctrine of affinities, which is what Moods was supposed to be about, made no sense. And then he wrote, "We are utterly weary of stories about precocious little girls. The two most striking facts with regard to Moods are the author's ignorance of human nature and her self-confidence in spite of that ignorance." Nice, huh? So James and Alcott remained friends, however, and to me, it's a tribute to her that they stayed friends, and also, of course, she was a tremendous influence on Henry James. He went on to write many novels about precocious little girls, many with names very much like Louisa May Alcott characters. There's a lot of overlap. She wrote about Vevay, he wrote about Vevay. She wrote about Joe March, he wrote about Isabel Archer. In other words, you can see her influence on him, but it starts here with this really quite savage review. So all the information that she's getting is, you're a lousy writer, you're a lousy writer, you're a lousy writer. So this, of course, is fodder for her. And then what happened? Another accident. The Civil War started, and of course the Civil War had a huge, disastrous, tragic effect on everything in Concord and everything in Boston. And Louisa May Alcott decided she couldn't just sit around, so she decided to become a Civil War nurse. And that was, you know, a fairly radical decision in those days. And she got enlisted through a woman named Dorothea Dix, who was running the nursing service. Before then, most nurses had been men. And she went down to Washington, D.C., where she served as a nurse in the Union Hotel Hospital in Washington, D.C. And she got there, you know, in many ways a complete innocent. And as it happened, the day after she arrived, General Ambrose Burnside ordered 14 unsuccessful charges on the hills of Fredericksburg. And so the Union carnage that day was unbelievable, which is a whole other story. But the next morning, Louisa May Alcott looked out the window of the hospital, and she saw what she thought were farmers coming to market, a line of wagons that stretched out to the horizon. And of course, they were wagons filled with the wounded and the dead from Fredericksburg coming to her hospital. So she, who had never seen a naked man, set to nursing these poor men, many of them dying, many of whom died on her watch. She learned how to write letters to their families. She learned, she told them stories from Dickens. She did whatever she could, and she loved it. Everything that Louisa May Alcott hated, all the phoniness, all the niminy-piminy chits, all the shame about being endlessly poor, all the embarrassment about her father fell away, and it was really just life and death. And she not only became the woman that we know as Louisa May Alcott, but she found her mature writing style. And her letters home that she wrote from the Union Hospital, there is nothing extraneous. They are vivid, they are beautiful, they are simple, they are humorous. They're just beautiful letters. She got very sick down there. She had a bronchial infection, and of course, in those days, in the 1860s, they thought that disease fed on the body, and so the more powerful the emetic, the better the healing would be. So they dosed everybody with mercury, and of course, everybody died. She didn't die, but she got very, very sick, so sick that Bronson had to go down and get her and bring her back to Concord. where she started to recover very slowly. She lost all her hair. Her hands were all cramped up. She had to learn to write with her left hand. She was in bed for months. She was really sick. But Bronson took all these letters that she had written home with her help and made a little book, which is right here, called Hospital Sketches, which is an extraordinary book. It's a memoir of her time in the Civil War. You know, it's interesting that Walt Whitman was down there, too. He had gone to Fredericksburg to look for his brother, George. And George, as it turned out, was okay. But Walt Whitman was so touched by what he saw at Fredericksburg that he also went to Washington and became a Civil War nurse. And so they were both in Boston marketing books about being Civil War nurses. And Whitman assured his publisher that he wasn't just going to write sketches, you know, like Louisa May Alcott did. Anyway, she wrote a wonderful book, and she really found her writing style under all those pressures. So, in 1868, when Thomas Niles, who was then her editor, came to her and said, "The only book of yours I could really publish would be a book for young women," she was horrified. Did they ask Emerson to write a book for young women? Did they ask Thoreau to write a book for young women? She did not want to write a book for young women. She felt she had earned the right to write another serious book. And she said, Louisa May Alcott, she said she would do it and didn't do it. And so what happened was Thomas Niles, who was a sort of one of history's inspired bullies, wrote a letter to Bronson Alcott, you know, remember, the bad writer, saying, "You know, if Louisa would write this book, we could publish your next book." And so Bronson Alcott got to work and started writing Louisa letters saying, "You have to come home from Concord. I've promised Mr. Niles that you're working on this book." And eventually she gave in and went back to Concord and in February of 1868, and she stalled. She didn't want to do it. January, February, March, April. She did everything else but write this book. And finally, she sat down in May of 1868 and wrote it very fast. Of course, she wrote about her sisters. She wrote about what she knew. And of course, she didn't really write about her sisters. She did that thing which I think often creates great literature. She wrote about the sisters she yearned to have. She wrote about the family she longed to have. She created a servant who did the work that Louisa herself had often done, Hannah, right? And instead of losing her hair to disease, she has Joe cut her hair off as a loving sacrifice. She didn't think the book was that great. Thomas Niles didn't think the book was that great. But as soon as it came out, letters started to pour in to both the publishing house and to Louisa May Alcott. And within 6 months, she was one of the best-selling writers in the world and one of the wealthiest. Thomas Niles said, "Let me write you a check for whatever amount you like." So that was... that was huge, and it took her a while to adjust to it. And she did a lot of other interesting. Her life didn't end then, but in a way, that's sort of the middle of the story. You have to read the rest of the book to find out what happened after that. I just want to say, I think for Louisa May Alcott, the stick to your teaching line stayed in her mind, and she wrote a letter in 1871, long after she was beloved and wealthy and famous, she wrote a little letter to James Fields that I'm going to read to you. "Dear Mr. Fields," Louisa wrote, "once upon a time you lent me $40, kindly saying that I might return them when I had made a pot of gold. As the miracle has been unexpectedly wrought, I wish to fulfill my part of the bargain and herewith repay my debt with many thanks. Very truly yours, Louisa May Alcott." So I want to suggest a little bit that it isn't just perversity that is the engine for writing. There's a little bit of revenge in there. And I feel that when she sat down to write this letter to thank him for the $40 that she loaned him so that she could teach better, it was a tremendously satisfying moment. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how I came to write this book. It also was a series of unfortunate accidents, as you can imagine, or accidents at least. I was in 1999, started. I was chatting with my then literary agent on the phone, and she wanted to get me off the phone. And she said, Random House, there's my current literary agent who never wants to get me off the phone. Random House wants somebody to write an introduction to a new edition of Little Women. You can do that. I'm sending it to you. Click. So I thought, okay. And the book came, and I thought, well, I better reread Little Women. So I went out and got a copy of Little Women and reread it, and it knocked my socks off. I was amazed. I had no idea. It's a great novel. You know, by that time I had taught the novel. I knew a little bit about novels. I thought it was a great novel if you were a miserable 18-year-old who ate the apple. It actually is a great novel by any standard. So that got me started. And then I wanted to know everything about Louisa May Alcott. So I started with Martha Saxton's biography. And I read that Laurie in Little Women was based on Henry David Thoreau. So I went, he was? Now, it turns out he was based on a lot of people, including Henry David Thoreau, but I was stunned. I had no idea that Louisa May Alcott was part of this community of great men. No idea at all. To me, they existed in different parts of the forest. So the more I read, the more fascinated I got. And I got very fascinated with this Concord community, you know, this crossroads where all of American literature, in fact, was written, or most of American literature was written, certainly most of 19th century American literature. And Louisa May Alcott was right there in the middle of things. So I wrote a book about that, American Bloomsbury, about that group of people. And the more research I did about Louisa May Alcott, the more interested I got. What I did with American Bloomsbury was I thought, what if you took the transcendentalist circle and put the women in? Because no one had done that. Many brilliant people wrote books about the transcendentalists, but they always left out Louisa May Alcott and Margaret Fuller and Lydia and Emerson as if they weren't there. So I thought, well, what do you put? Well, what you get is, of course, sex and trouble and all kinds of things. But so that made it fun to write about. But I got more and more interested in Louisa May Alcott and more fascinated by the way the problems that she embodies in her life and dealt with in her work are the problems that we have today, that I have, that my daughter has. This tension between how to make a life for oneself, whether you should use your sexual currency to attract some guy who's going to take care of the money part, whether you should try to have a career on your own, whether you should try to do both at the same time. And that's really what she's writing about. And it's also what her life is about. She got very upset with the success of Little Women when she got hundreds of letters begging her to have Joe marry Laurie. And she wrote in her journal, I will not, under any circumstances, let Joe marry Laurie, right? But she kind of compromised and produced Professor Bear. But, you know, she was upset by that. And when you sit in front of Orchard House in Concord, as you certainly should, it's an extraordinary place, you see, 100,000 people a year go there, and many of them are young women. And it's like, it looks like Mecca. I've never been to Mecca, but you know, they're walking up the path and they look as if, you know, these beautiful young women think that somehow they'll get some guidance, you know, from this wonderful woman, from this wonderful house and this work. And I think that, you know, although there are no answers in Little Women, that there's certainly clarity about this problem, which is really all anybody can give anybody else. So I got more and more obsessed with her, and I wrote this book. So I would love it if you asked me questions. As you may or may not know, Thoreau went to Walden not to write a book, but because he was writing another book about a river trip he had taken with his brother. And it was only at a lecture, when everybody asked him what it was like to live in a hut on Walden Pond, in the Q&A, that he realized that he had a book there. So I'm a great believer in the magic of Q&A, which I hope we will now indulge in. Thanks very much. Yes. Edith Wharton's much later. Much, much later. Yes. Well, they overlapped. Henry James was very young when he wrote that mean stuff about Louisa, and he had a pretty long life. How long did Henry James live? 1910, and he was born in 1850? So not so long. But yes, they had that in common, certainly. And many other things. I mean, I think this is also Edith Wharton's subject, and I certainly think Edith Wharton read Louisa May Alcott, although I can't prove it. Yes. She was 32. She became a nurse in 1862, so she was 32. Yes. She was pretty old. Dorothea Dix had this idea that nurses should be very plain, so she wanted unmarried women over 30. Or long married women over 30. And Louisa applied and was accepted. She didn't want any distraction in the wards. She got no training, no. And the whole business of being a nurse was so new in those days, you know. I mean, the other nurses sort of trained her. She wore a little red thing around her head. You know, she learned what to do from other people. But nurses up until then had mostly been men. It was thought that women couldn't nurse men. So it was, you know, part of a whole big shift. But it was a fantastic thing for her to do. And she just ended up right in the thick of things. Yes? Yes, Bronson Alcott. I had a very successful school called the Temple School in Boston when Louisa was small, when she was 3. And it was... he started a school and he got all of, you know, he got the Quincy's and the Davenports and the Lowells and the Cabots to send their children to his school. Of course, the children were delighted by the school. Then he got Elizabeth Peabody to come and kind of keep a record of the school. And she wrote a book called Record of a School, which was a huge bestseller, not just in Boston, but in New York. People came from all over the world to watch Bronson teach these children. And indeed, there's a picture of it. You know, it was a wonderful environment. Even now, it looks like a wonderful environment. He had a lot of stuff around, alarm clocks and magnets and things to play with, and you were allowed to stand up when you talked, and, you know, all kinds of things went on that were so much better than other schools at the time. But I think he was a brilliant progressive educator. The trouble is that he was a man who could not engage with the world successfully. So what happened with the Temple School was that, you know, there was an economic depression in Boston. People started taking their children out of school. It was expensive. He spent all the money. When he got money, he spent it, plowed it back into the school, letting his debts pile up. And then, he had to move the school from this wonderful room at the top of the Temple to the basement of the Temple. And then he enrolled an African-American child, and everyone else pulled their children out, and then he had his 4 original students, his daughters. So that's what happened to that school, but he had 3 different schools, and everyone met with a different kind of disaster, which he somehow brought on himself. He just wasn't very good at supporting himself or other people. And some of his ideas were pretty loony. You know, he thought he was going to make a living as a farmer. But as an educator, clearly he was quite brilliant and very ahead of his time. What? Well, I don't know, but I'll bet you that A.S. Neal read The Record of a School. I mean, the Temple School was very much like Summerhill. You know, it was this incredible experiment that people who loved it just adored it. But unlike A.S. Neal, he couldn't make it, he couldn't sustain it. He couldn't seem to sustain anything. At first, most people, when they first read about Louisa, they hate Bronson because he put this burden on her of really having to be the adult in the family. But as somebody who benefited hugely from alternative education myself, I would not be standing here. if there was not such a thing as progressive education. I have a soft spot for him. You know, he really clearly, it was fun to be at his school. But then he followed a record of a school with another book called Conversations with Children on the Gospels. And he started asking the children about the Virgin Mary and where they thought babies came from and did they think that rich people could really be good people. And, you know, yeah, exactly, exactly. But he's pretty interesting. Yes. Very tenuous. Again, Mark Twain is later. Bronson, of course, loved Mary Baker Eddy, went to her parlor, thought she was fantastic. You know, Louisa did not like Mary Baker Eddy, but she did, when she was very sick, go to a Christian Science, whatever they're called, healer, who wasn't Mrs. Eddy, but was somebody else. But Mark Twain was pretty late, because by the time Mark Twain, there's a terrible scene with Mark Twain and Emerson, where Emerson has Alzheimer's, whether or not it's all right to give somebody a 21st century diagnosis, let's put that aside for a minute. It's probably not. But Emerson had really lost his mind, and Mark Twain gave a toast to Emerson, and Emerson, of course, just had no idea what was going on, and they were both very abashed by it. But that's later. That's the 1870s, the 1880s. Yes. She loved her sisters. You know, Bronson Alcott created this myth of family. They were Alcotts first, and everything else second, third, and fourth, and it really worked. The sisters stayed very close. Of course, the youngest sister died. But in the end, May, I guess the sister that Louisa was closest to, who's Amy in the book, in as much as fiction has any correlation with reality, which is yet another discussion, went to live in France and married and had a child, and May died, and Louisa ended up raising her child. Louisa was devastated by her death, and Louisa also was able to pay for May. May was a very accomplished painter. Louisa was able to pay for her to have training and to study with the right people. And so they were very, very close. They stayed very close. Yes. Well, the mother was pretty nice. Not as nice as Marmee. But, you know, she had temper tantrums. She got depressed. The mother was very active in service. She, at one point, ran a kind of homeless shelter in Boston at a time when, you know, during the Irish immigration. So, you know, she was a very active, what are we going to call her, community organizer, much more so than in the book. And I think that she, you know, Louisa was a very difficult child. And, of course, she was especially difficult for her father, but she was also difficult for her mother. She would run away. They couldn't find her. You know, her mother had to tie her to the furniture to keep her from running away, which is really not my idea of how you keep children from running away. So, you know, it wasn't, I mean, Little Women is the family that she desperately, desperately yearned to have. But I think, you know, ABBA did her best. I mean, she, you know, poor ABBA. I mean, she was almost 30 years old. She had had this wonderful life in a beautiful house in Boston, and then her father remarried. And her father married a woman. Her mother died. Her father remarried a woman who didn't like her much. So basically, she had nowhere to go. So she went to visit her brother, and who should she run into but Bronson Alcott? So, you know, she had had a difficult life, and certainly being married to Bronson was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. I mean, he started a utopia, you know, where he invited 15 people to come and live in this tiny little farmhouse as big as this glass, and she had to take care of them and cook for them. And, you know, I mean, it was very, very difficult being married to him. So I tend to like her, although I don't think she treated Louisa as well as I think Louisa should have been treated. Someone else had their hand up. Yes. Well, I don't know. Do you have a happy life? I'm not sure how to calibrate. You know, you're not the first person. She certainly had renown. She certainly had admirers. She did not have good health after the Civil War. She never had good health. But she had very good health until she went to the Civil War. I think, you know, in many ways it was a very difficult life. The poverty, the shame of the poverty, the inability to do the things that she might have wanted to do as a young girl, go to dances, get married, flirt, because somebody had to be nose to the grindstone. The querulous, childish parents. The what felt like a betrayal to her of her older sister getting married as soon as she could. Who can blame her? You know, I think there were tremendous difficulties in her life, but she wrote some books that still speak to us today, and I think she knew she had. But I guess I don't, I'm going to say this and you have to forget that I said it. I'm not sure that writers have happy lives in the way that I'm not sure those two things go together any more than writers making a lot of money go together, or perhaps even less than writers making a lot of money go together. In other words, if, as I'm arguing, you know, a lot of the energy to write comes from perversity and a desire for revenge, well, you have to have something to revenge, don't you? So I don't know. That's just a theory. To my mind, she did have a happy life. She was able to have an effect in the world. She was able to engage in the world. And she had a voice. You know, people listened to her. People read what she wrote. And they still do. So I think that's much happier than if she'd married Laurie. Not that that was even open to her or that he even existed. But but it's an interesting question. There's one question that everybody asks, did she have a happy life? And then there's one thing that everybody says, I am Jo March. So those are the two things I've been hearing a lot, and I've only been out here for 2 days. So, yes. No, he certainly did not. No, I think they're too. I mean, she read the Brontes. She read a lot, but I think the only writer she cared about pleasing were Emerson, Thoreau, and her father, and possibly Hawthorne. You know, those were her neighbors. But I think what happened to her was she stopped caring about pleasing them, and that's when she became a writer. I think as long as she was trying to please those guys, she was writing moods. The doctrine of affinities. You know, you could just go right to sleep. But as soon as she stopped worrying about what other writers thought, no, Walt Whitman, those people, even now, you know, Louisa May Alcott is trivialized. Even now, she's not taught. She's not taught in college. I mean, I'm an American studies major. Nobody ever mentioned to me that she was there writing with the rest of them. She's completely trivialized now. So imagine what it was like then. Yes?
You were saying that when she started school, she didn't want to write for the young women, for the young girls. But I was wondering if after the success, she went on to write. She was building up a very great book.
She changed her mind. You're absolutely right. She liked writing for young adults. Then she wrote Little Men. Then she wrote Rose and Bloom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But she kept on rewriting moods. And later, when she could publish whatever she wanted, she rewrote and republished moods. So clearly, both of those things were going on in her mind. And I think that she had found her true style in Hospital Sketches and in Little Women, and that she knew that, but it's hard to account for her obsession with mood, especially when you read it. Yes.
My question is sort of what you said before. Why is she a native when so much interest now in Emily Dickinson? Say,
I'm very interested in her literature, and I'm hoping that, you know, my book can be part of bringing her back and having her work regarded as literary work rather than something we read when we were 16 and you know, were miserable, because I think it is great literary work. But that's a really good question. But I think, you know, in general, women are trivialized. I don't mean this in a... don't take this the wrong way. And in general, books for children are trivialized. So she's got those two things against her, so to speak. And then also, she had the bad luck and the good luck to be part of this extraordinary group of intellectuals. So, but I think it's quite possible that she could be rehabilitated, that her, that somebody might write a book about her influence. You know, her influence on Henry James is just so fascinating. Somebody might write a great essay about that, or even a book about the two of them. You know, her influence, that her, you know, her making domestic details worthy of literature, in a sense. I mean, Hospital Sketches is the first memoir, or one of the first memoirs, American memoirs, but also Little Women is kind of the harbinger of the memoir, because it says this stuff about whether or not your gloves fit, you can put that in a book. You know, these silly little things that women say to each other in the kitchen and the ladies' room, and, you know, that's okay. You can put those details in a book. So I think she's tremendously important from a literary point of view, and hope that, you know, she might get more literary attention. In fact, I would hope that there would now be more books by those Harvard guys about the transcendentalists in which the women would be included, also Margaret Fuller. You know, but it's happening. Two people are now writing biographies of Margaret Fuller, so that's good too. But, you know, I think many people who should be more esteemed from a literary point of view are not more esteemed, and I think she's certainly one of them. It is. It is still widely read. There are 13 to 15 editions of it in print. As I said, between 50 and 100,000 people a year go to Orchard House. So it is still widely read. It's an e-book, of course. You can read it on your phone. But it's still out there, yes. Yes. Well,
I think
I agree, but you certainly don't read about her when you take a literary course in college. You know, the minute you leave high school, and you can study Henry James till you're blue in the face, you'll never read. Well, exactly. Adults read Henry James, exactly. So one more question? Oh, you know, I have to admit, I loved them all. I mean, it was really fun to write this book, but watching those movies, I like the Winona Ryder version. Is that horrible to say? Oh, sorry. I mean, the Katharine Hepburn version is so Katharine Hepburn. And the June Allison version is so June Allison, whereas Winona Ryder seems more permeable to me. You know? Anyway, good question. Thanks. Thank you.
So thank you all for coming. We do have two of Susan's books for sale tonight, American Bloomsbury, and of course her Alcott book. And if you would like to have a look at a couple of the rare book volumes that we have here, please come up to the front. And Susan is available to sign copies of her books as well. Thank you all. It's 7:25. Yes, no, we're good. Yeah. You were great. You were great.